tribulation was to those from opposed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so what we're going to do now is continue from the point at which you have landed. You've been arrested,
yes,
as it were. And can you take us through from this point?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Well, I was picked up by the Luftwaffe, and I think it was the searchlight unit they belonged to. And they'd obviously either been warned by somebody else about London, or they'd heard the commotion going on overhead and were looking for a crash plane, and they found me. And they were very considerate towards me, and they sent for this medical sergeant. He spent quite a long time checking me over, different things, and probing about. I think he was looking for shrapnel. I had quite bad gashes in my legs and that. I think he was probing for shrapnel. He thought it was anti-aircraft fire or something. No. And I couldn't tell him any different because it all happened that quickly. So that's what I got to. And then from there, from that, what I think was a searchlight unit, could have been, they took me off. They sent for me then from their headquarters of what this unit belonged to. And I was spent the night there. Lo and behold, I found my parachute that I thought I'd hidden very well, and they tossed that to me and told me to lay down on the floor. And the sergeant sat at the desk all through the night with his eye on me. I didn't want to sleep very much, didn't feel like sleeping. But then in the quite early in the morning, they removed me from this room that I was in, and took me to what was part of the living quarters, and I'm sure they were searchlight units. And they were pretty good to me. They weren't too hostile, and they were, seemed to be very envious in telling me that for me the war is over. And that thought they would like to be in my position, I think. Anyway, we went from there and we were taken into the next day, David was brought in the back of a terrific great Mercedes-Benz, wonderful looking vehicle, with two very smart Luftwaffe officers, and they came to collect me. They'd already picked up David, and they got me in the back there, and we were forbidden to talk to each other. And the guy in the passenger seat, he was nursing his pistol the whole time. So we didn't attempt any escapes or anything like that. And we were taken to Tempelhof Aerodrome in the middle of Berlin, and put in what I think was a cellar there. We met up with several other RAF bomber crews. Most of them looked about as knocked about as we were, in need of some attention. And we spent, I think, one or two nights there at Tempelhof Airport, aerodrome, and they we were then taken off to Frankfurt on Main for interrogation. But we went in an ordinary passenger train, quite luxurious really, but we were warned by our escort to conceal ourselves as much as possible, because the civilian population were extremely hostile towards Allied airmen. So we kept as quiet as possible, and eventually, without incident on the train, arrived at the Frankfurt station. But there, something happened, a plate layer, I think it was. It leapt up from the rail track onto the platform and took a swipe at one of our members, the RAF man, with a hammer or a hatchet or something. And I don't think he actually hit him. He managed to dodge or something, but what it did, it brought the attention to the fact that we were there, who we were, to these crowds on the platform. And they were surging towards us, wanting to get their hands on us. But luckily, the escort, who we'd been with, the German escort, he knew his job very well, the sergeant in charge of them. And he immediately pushed us against the wall and formed a, with his men, formed a semicircle around us. And he made it, although he was speaking in German, he made it quite clear that he was going to open fire if these civilians came any nearer. So very grudgingly, they gradually edged away. And I imagine shouting all sorts of curses at us. And then, funnily enough, we went from Frankfurt on main rail station, we went on a tram to get to Zuidlaagluft, which was in the suburbs of Frankfurt. Seemed a bit, bit of a funny way to transport prisoners, but it was all right. We had a tram for ourselves and a substantial guard keep an eye on us. And off we went, and we were delivered to quite close to the entrance of Zuidlaagluft. Yes, Zuidlaagluft. And straight away we were confronted with a bit of psychology. They had smashed one of the windows in the front door or somewhere in the front of the building, and they'd stuffed it up with window. Did you know what that was? It was some aluminium foil that we used to drop to foil their radar.
Yes, indeed.
And it had been stuffed up with that, you see, this great pane of glass. And nobody said anything. They didn't draw our attention to it or anything, but it was there as a psychological dig to say, we know what you call this stuff. And you thought it was a well-guarded secret, didn't you? But we know everything. So, anyway, from there we were taken off to be thoroughly searched by a very uncouth group of Luftwaffe airmen, had to strip right out naked, everything off, no attention paid to any injuries that we were suffering from, and then you're quite on your own, of course, at this stage, you're separated from the rest of the party, quite on your own. And they knew a lot, and they made sure that I knew that they knew a lot, because they grabbed my brass jacket, the blouse, and knew exactly where to look, or sewn into the waistband was some. I forget what I'm saying now. A compass. No, the compass was in one of the buttons. That was it.
Right.
And what was sewn into the waistband was some mats and something to help us escape if we got the chance. But they let me see they knew of their existence and they knew all about them. And they didn't ask me a lot of questions. Well, I don't think they were a very bright lot, really. They were more brutal than bright. And they, just prior to being shot down, we'd been issued with these lovely silken wool long john underpants, which were a great benefit, of course, in the cold weather. And they were ridiculous. You know, they didn't actually say so, but they say, well, we're Germans, we're most modern, we don't wear things like that anymore, you know. Anyway, before I knew any more, these two guards had appeared, had obviously been summoned to be there. And I was taken off down these endless corridors and put in a very tiny cell. And I knew that I was in entirely on my own. There was nobody in the cell adjoining it, but nowhere in the vicinity, because I could hear nothing. And you can imagine how miserable I felt, being more or less thrown into this cell.
Mm-hmm.
And very tiny too, just enough to, for a small bunk bed to be there. And on that there was two or three filthy looking blankets, and bang, the door was shut on me, and I was left to stew there, not knowing what was going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
As time went on, I was bought some food, not very appetizing, because I was still in benefit of what I'd had back in the UK. Didn't feel like eating their food. And I think I was left there for 2 days, absolutely on my own. And then at about midday, I was called in for to be interrogated for the first time. And there was a lot of psychology in that, I know that now, but more than I did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And by actually saying nothing to me for several minutes after I got into the presence of this German intelligence officer, he was looking at some papers, didn't give me any real attention at all. Then suddenly he turned around, and I was accused of not being a British aircrew member at all, but an agent, espionage agent.
Mm-hmm.
I was in that Lancaster to be dropped for espionage purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reminded why he knew this, or he thought he knew it, because I just wasn't wearing my identity disc. I'd been for a wash just before briefing, left them hanging up in the wash place, forgot all about them until we were just about taking off when I remembered them. Too late to do anything about it then.
Mm.
And he picked up this fact, you see, and made the most of it. And said that, you know, if I was a British airman, I would have identity discs on. So he was using that as a threat all the time. He was trying to get me to prove that I was a British airman. Well, we were told to say nothing except your name, number and rank. That's what was always thumbed into us by the RAF intelligence officers.
Mm-hmm.
And we had lectures about being taken prisoner. And he was probing for more, of course, kept probing for more.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, it just sent me back to my cell. Because you don't know anything about this, the guards are summoned secretly. He must have had a bell push or something there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was ready, he sent for these guards, and they took me back into the cell and slammed the door. I was absolutely bewildered by then, and it came to me that, you know, perhaps I should have had these discs. Of course I should have done.
Mm-hmm.
And how am I going to prove that I'm a British airman without giving something away?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to remember that you were just, what, 21? At that point?
Sorry?
You were just 21 years of age?
That's right, 21 years of age, yes.
So you're a very young man still.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I know now how much psychology was put into these interrogations.
Mm.
That I perhaps wasn't aware of then, you know.
Mm.
I knew what happened. And anyway, I was shut back in there for 2 days, I think, before I was called before this same guy again, and he said, well, if you're a British airman, tell me where you were stationed, and this sort of thing, and where did you do your training? And I knew I mustn't tell him anything like that. It had been drilled into us enough by RAF intelligence.
Mm.
In fact, don't get into any sort of conversation at all, because they're so clever in switching in questions when you're not expecting them. So once again he dismissed me, more or less, said, well, that's it then, you're, as far as I'm concerned, you're a spy. took me off again. And by this time, I'd sort of regained consciousness and that. You know, it's surprising how long I suppose being in that terrible crash. I got a concussion, I suppose, and shock. And you could feel the effect of it coming on, you know, in the... in your mind, you couldn't concentrate on things very well.
Mm.
But like I say, in my youth, I wasn't quite so aware of it as I am now, what the effect of it was.
Mm.
Anyway, another couple of days, I was left to stew all the time in this absolute solitude.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody to talk to you, nothing. The only connection you got was at meal times, if you could call them meals, this food was pushed through the door. And that was the only contact you had.
Yeah. So what was the food that you were being given?
Well,
soup or something?
A bit of this dark bread,
mm-hmm.
very dark, sour tasting bread,
mm-hmm.
and a bit of what I know was ersatz jam. It wasn't proper jam at all on it.
Mm-hmm.
And a small metal container full of ersatz coffee.
Right.
And then at midday, you did get about three small potatoes and a little drop of soup, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's totally inadequate to keep you going, you know. But then again, I don't think I was thinking too much about food then. I suppose we were still benefiting from the RAF food, and hunger doesn't kick in that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite content to stay as far away from the Germans as I could. I didn't want their food or anything. Anyway, the next time I was called before a German intelligence officer, I didn't realise I was being taken to a different place, but until they actually opened the door, I realised it was a different man this time, and he had a totally different attitude to me, quite friendly, and he said, right, he said, we are both wireless people, technicians, he said, technicians, we are, so we understand each other, don't we? He tried to put in one or two things, you know, but then he suddenly says, well, are you carrying fish bombs?
Yes.
Yeah, then I probably got with the book, but this, given the demonstration of fish bombs, which was a new sort of device we were carrying, so that it was based on radar to detect enemy fighters coming up from behind. So we already had what we called the oil moniker, which gave a blip, 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 blip noise.
Mm-hmm.
But this fish bomb was a radar screen, and we could actually see the aircraft that it had picked up. So we could give its direction to the gunners,
mm-hmm.
tell them where it's coming from, and whether it's up or down, and it was quite a good thing. But it was supposed to be absolutely dead top secret. Oh, you mustn't breathe a word of this outside. This is from the demonstration by the RAF.
Yes.
But like I say, this man confronted me with it all, told me about it, and then he suddenly says, oh, you're not giving away any secrets. Come with me. And he took me into another room. And there was fish pond set up and working.
Lord.
And he gave me a second demonstration of it, its qualities, you know. So that was psychology piled on, I'm sure, you know.
Yes, indeed.
That. Anyway, he asked me another couple of things, but all the time he had quite a friendly attitude, this man,
mm-hmm.
compared with the first interrogator. Anyway, I was sent back from there, and then I had about another two or three sessions with the first man, and he was trying to get something out of me. And one time he said, all right, if you're me where you were at the station, where were you trained? And I thought, well, I can't tell him that. Of course, I was not, nothing to tell him that. Mm-hmm. He suddenly produced this great book, and he flung it across the table at me and said, you're not giving away any secrets. Look in there. And I started to flip this book. He urged me to look at it. He wanted me to look at it. And I started to look at it, and I realised in this book was... the names of all RAF stations in Great Britain and what units or squadrons were stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, golly, that's just most of it. But just then his telephone rang.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to take his eyes off me while he answered that. And I took this opportunity to flip through the book to see if there was the two new airfields that I knew about, not been in commission very long, to see if they were in his book, but they weren't. That gave me a bit of confidence. I thought, well, he doesn't know everything then, does he? But anyway, this telephone call that came must have been more important than willing me, and the next thing I know, the guards had opened the door and taken me back to myself.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't end properly. I saw the same guy probably on three or four occasions, and it was left that I was a spy and I would be taken away to the Gestapo, and you know what they will do to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I realised I was likely to be shot, you see. And that was how it was left, probably nine days, I think it was.
Wow.
I was in that state. And then the next thing I knew, the door was flung open, the gate by these guards. They said, pick up your belongings, you're going. And I thought, oh, no, this is it, I'm off to be shot. And anyway, I went through this, and this Gulag Loop is a maze of corridors. And I went through several of these, and I had the slightest idea where I was coming to. And I thought, well, surely I'm going to the Gestapo now. And then suddenly we came to this big door, and it looked like a door, an exit door. I thought, good Lord, they're going to shoot me here. You know, I'm not going, they're going to shoot me in this yard. But anyway, when the door was opened fully, it wasn't into a yard at all. It was into quite a large room. And it was full of Allied airmen, all jovial, smoking cigarettes, and a feeling of well-being. And they soon assured me that my interrogation was now over. You're in the clear now, and we're on our way to prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
And that afternoon, we were taken off into... out off to a railway siding, and there was this long freight train waiting, but there was one of the trucks had been fitted out especially to take us, and it was very well fortified with barbed wire and partitioned off so that we were shut into the end sections of this trunk, this truck. And the guards occupied the only part where there's any exit doors, so there's no chance of getting out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no idea where we were going. We weren't told where we were going, but the next day we were able, because the door was slid open just a little bit, people who could see out the door could see that they got enough clues to say that we were going northwards,
mm-hmm.
going to the north. And we were probably going up into the very north of Germany. But anyway, we could see why the journey was taking a long time, because quite frequently we were put in a siding while the more important trains carrying things like field guns and lorries were hustled past us. They got absolute priority, and we had no priority whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, anyway, eventually we arrived at what we knew was going to be Stalaglov 6. And there was a strong detergent of guards waiting there for us to supplement the guards that were already with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were marched from the railway station to the prison camp. And that was the first idea of what you're going into, this very heavily barbed wire place.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely impregnable, either getting in or getting out of it.
Mm.
And the compound, that's the part, the section of the camp that we were put in, was fully, mostly American air crew.
Right.
And there was only a few British airmen in there. And we got on quite well with these Americans, quite a good quite an experience, because in those days we'd never met a real in the flesh American, I don't think. We expected them to be, well, I did anyway, I don't know about the others, expected them to be quite different to us, because all we knew about them was what we saw on the American films.
Yes.
And they were all rich. They all got big cars, posh, very good-looking girlfriends, all that. And they were quite no different to us. And when you get talking to them, you realise they only did ordinary jobs, like clerks and plumbers and fitters and that sort of thing. So they were really no different to us, which was very surprising. But anyway, we got on quite well with them. We learned to play their ball games, like hardball and softball. But they were a bit different in that respect. They tried to, but they applied psychology to the man with the baton, the other time. They were shouting all sorts of insults at him, hoping that he would miss the ball, be it tossed at him, you see. Which is something that we wouldn't ever do in cricket, most un-British.
Yes. Yeah.
So, anyway, we got on with those lives, as I say, got on very well, and we got used to how little food we were going to get, but also at that time there was the British Red Cross parcels were quite evident, quite plentiful. We had regularly one parcel a week, which it didn't stop me from being hungry, but it stopped you from starving. You weren't starving. And we're most grateful for these parcels. And they did come, as I say, quite regularly, and no problem at all. But as the war went on, they became more and more scarce, and we were having to rely on this very meek German rations to live on, and we wouldn't have lived much longer if we hadn't been liberated, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we were moved into a different compound in Stalaglov 6 and met up with some old established Kriegers, as we called them. That's the name for where the prisoners of war. You're a Kriegi.
Yes.
And it's part of a great long word, Kriegs, Gefangen and something.
Yes.
Which meant prisoner of war in Germany, you think.
Yes.
And we were moved into this different part, and they were all British in there. In fact, there were members from my squadron, 166 squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And some had been there in the bag for 2 years then. And they wanted to know what went on in the squadron, but you had to be very careful what you say, because we were made so aware by British intelligence that if you were in a prison camp, there would be plenty of microphones about and always somebody eavesdropping. And, well, I haven't mentioned before, in Stalaglov, they knew there were British airmen who had turned traitor. They'd gone over to the Germans.
Yes.
And they were there in their British uniforms. And the information they were asked to get from the German bosses.
Mm-hmm.
But we had been warned about them very,
yes.
very strongly from British intelligence. Yeah.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed.
So anyway, we got used to being in this more established part of the camp. We got the British BBC News bulletin come twice a day. And what it was like the headlines of the news of the how the war was going out throughout the world, and, but never any mention of air raids or anything like that on Britain, or anything to do with losses or anything like that, of air aircraft in Germany. Nothing like that was ever given.
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose was wise, because it was only, couldn't do any good, could it?
Mm-hmm.
But it was always nice to think you were getting a bit of news from home. And then after some months there, we were moved off again to Poland. And it was here, there, in that move, I lost contact with David. Mm-hmm. He'd been separated off, taken off to a different prison camp altogether. And we were taken off to this huge camp in Poland, where we were very glad to get used to having much more room to walk about in. And the weather was warmer, of course. We thought we'd got on there and thought we'd landed in clover than we got over. But anyway, as I say, the food got scarce and scarcer, and we knew that we weren't going to do any good there. And it, we'd not been there that long before we were hustled up again, because we could hear the German guns in the distance, the Russian guns, rather, in the distance, and we knew that the Russians weren't far off from there. We were brought back into Germany, 30 miles north of Hanover. And that was a long and a very huge camp area. Each camp wasn't that big, but there were many of them. And scattered around this place called Follenbostel.
Mm-hmm.
That was the name of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And things got worse and worse as we got there. We got certainly no food parcels at all. We started off with getting a half parcel, then we got a quarter parcel the last week.
Mm-hmm.
Then they disappeared altogether.
So what were in the food parcels?
Oh, well, common all-day things like a quarter pound, a packet of tea, and a tin of sausages, perhaps, and a tin of meat, a tin of salmon.
Mm-hmm.
They varied a bit, which was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, it wasn't enough to really say, oh, that was a lovely meal, but at least it kept you from dying of starvation, which is probably what would have happened. You'd have caught some disease which went through the camp like lightning, you know.
Yes.
I think that would have been the end of us, but we haven't had these Red Cross parcels.
Yes.
And the trouble was that they were still, was not, they weren't being sent from Canada and America and Britain. It was because they were being blown off the railway in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the commandant admitted this, that we didn't know whether to treat it as being a good thing or a bad thing.
Yes.
Like I put in my story, it's a case of good news, the fact that they're having the railways are being under great attack, but it also robbed us of our food parcels. So it was good and bad, it all wrapped up in one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we lost any tracks of what was really going on with the war, and we did hear about the taking of the bridge over the Rhine
mm-hmm.
at Arnhem.
Yes.
And that, we thought that was wonderful. We thought another week now we'll be free, you know, we'll be liberated. But no, of course, they couldn't get anything, although they took the bridge, which was a marvellous operation, of course. The British Army and the Navy couldn't get up to them to relieve them.
Mm-hmm.
So after a long and bitter fight, they had to surrender the bridge back to the Germans. And that was a terrible disappointment to us, to think that we were so near to being liberated that that happened.
Yes.
But eventually when liberation did come, it was quite different to what we thought it was going to be. It was so well organised, and nobody was marching or walking of the British forces. They all had transport of some sort. Either had their own small little vehicle, or they had a place in a larger lorry, but there was no reason for any of them to walk any or march anywhere. Mm-hmm. They were carried everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they'd got the thing really under control. Although the progress wasn't fast, it was steady and sure. But because of that, we didn't say we couldn't do it, but we were strongly advised to stop within the prison camp where they could look after us and don't try to go out because of the situation out there.
Mm.
The pockets of resistance,
yes,
that wouldn't surrender, fanatics, you know.
Yes, yes.
And anyway, that was, we had a couple of, as you read in the book, we had a couple of nasty experiences with that, partly because we didn't do what we were told, stopping the camp, but even after that, we came across a couple of difficult situations. But anyway, eventually from this place, Vollenbostel, we were taken off in groups to fly back to Britain, which was very, very nice to come back to.
Okay.
And remember, of course, I was only there about 16 months. So how these people who'd been there 4.5 years or more,
yes,
how they felt to get back, I really don't know.
Yes.
It was certainly good to get back.
Yes, but
we were treated wonderfully. And the organisation of getting us back was absolutely spot on, no snags whatsoever. Everything was there waiting for us. Very good.
So did you fly back on a Dakota? On a Dakota, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And you flew into which airport? Which airfield?
I'm trying to think what the name
of it. It would have been one in the southeast, presumably.
Just to the north west of London, not far off, it'll probably come to me, isn't it?
RAF Wing?
Yeah, it'll come to me, this phone's whistling a bit too.
Oh, don't worry, it's okay.
Anyway, I'll probably think of the name of the place, the name of the thing. But I don't know what it was, what they did normally. I think it was a transport airfield. I don't think there were any bomber or fighter squadrons there. They were transport aircraft, I think. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just looking this up in your book now. John's book, A Raid Over Berlin, published by Parthian. And I'm just having a quick look at the book here to see if I can find out. Where John arrived back into the. I can see that you were at RAF Cosford for a while. Ah, you landed late evening,
yes,
at RAF Wing.
Wing, that was it, Wing, yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's where we landed.
Yes.
Like I say, everything was laid on. We had the WAF, two WAFs for each man come out to escort you. I don't know whether we could just about walk, but They gave us a lot of support walking out there.
Wonderful.
There was a nice little picnic meal waiting for us. And they had got everything organised, trains, special trains laid on to take us, the RAF to Cosford. But I don't know where the army boys went to. They went to a different place altogether. But like I've put in the book, I hope they were treated as well as what we were. To get into a hot bath, that was a marvellous thing after all that time.
I bet.
And also to get into a bed with sheets, a proper bed with sheets.
Yes.
Oh, marvellously.
Yes, yes.
You read the book, there's a funny little coincidence there with the flight sergeant who were treated with terror, treating somebody terrible in our early days of training and that.
Yeah.
But there he was next morning bringing me a hot cup of tea. It's quite by coincidence that I knew him, you know.
Yes.
But what they'd obviously done was drafted a lot of personnel from different RAF stations to help receive the prisoners back, you see. And he'd been given that job quite lowly for him, I think.
Yes.
Because he was like the god in the early training days.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, you were returning heroes, essentially, weren't you? So I think it's perfectly justifiable.
I don't know about that, but yeah.
But you at Cosford, then you met up with your friend David from the POW camp.
Cosford.
Yeah.
And we returned to Cosford. I met David there, looking fit and well, and that. But like I got in the book, he had been suffering from bayonet wounds in his back. Because he was moved to a different camp to what I was when we were moved out of Follingbostel.
Yes.
Not Follingbostel, in the north of Germany. His heart was moved off into a different camp altogether. And they had a terrible time. You know, I'll never cease to feel how lucky we were to be separated off from them, taken on a different journey and arrived in a different camp entirely. Because they had a very, very bad time, they did. It's all in the book, you can read.
No, indeed. Well, I've virtually read the book anyway, so yeah. So can you tell me then, you and your wife Adelaide, you got married pretty soon after you came back, by the looks of it.
Well, a few months, September the 30th.
Uh-huh.
The 29th.
Oh,
I mustn't get that wrong, yeah. 29th of September.
Yeah.
1945, yeah.
Well. Yes.
I was still in the RAF, of course, and so was she, still in the WAF.
Yes, yes.
And by that time, I'd been sent off to a station to do some work.
Right.
The reception was over, and you were back working in the RAF. But
yeah.
I never went back on the flying duties.
Right.
No.
Right. So what did you then do? Did you carry on in the RAF for a number of years, or did you?
No, only because of the you realise the amount of, I don't know how many million people were called up from the population of Britain.
Yes.
And they had to be sent back in an orderly manner, because one thing, their food supply and the they all want some civilian dress to put on. They all want somewhere to live because there's been so much bombing in the towns and cities.
Yes.
And that was in short supply. So they couldn't just turn round to them and say, right, let's finish for you lot, then off you go.
Yes.
It was a very well organised thing, although we didn't look upon it like that, because when we were waiting to come out, we just thought it was one big bind.
Yes.
Use an RAF word.
Yes.
You know, something they like doing, but I can see now in my old age how essential it was not to just turn everybody adrift.
Yes.
And they all wanted the civilian job, of course, to go back to.
Yes, indeed.
So it was more than a year after the war, nearly 18 months after the war ended, and I went back to civilian life. But by that time, of course, I was a warrant officer and I had a cushy sort of life, very, very little work to do. Yes, it was quite nice.
So what did you then do?
Well, I was still taken up with my old job, because it's a funny thing about wireless operators, you're a bit different from the rest of the air crew because you're what they call an RAF tradesman.
Yes.
And you're entitled to a job in that trade because you've passed the necessary exams.
Yes.
And I was given this job partly to training Dutch sailors from the Royal Dutch Navy, sailors, to be air operators.
All right.
They would go out to the Far East.
Yes.
France. But the trouble was these Dutch sailors could send more to receive well, better than we could.
Right.
That wasn't really any embarrassment because we just worked at our own speed, you know.
Yes.
And that was quite interesting, but there wasn't really enough work to do.
No.
And everybody was who was going out under this demand scheme, they were all disgruntled and even quite high-ranking officers, if you had to go to them for some reason or other, they'd say, oh, what's your demand number then? And they were just waiting for theirs, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, they were wing commanders and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And they all had the same attitude. Come on, let's get out of it.
Yes.
And, of course, it was equally difficult for the regular RAF personnel to get back to their the living they wanted. You know, nobody had any much interest in what was going on, but they wanted to get interested again, of course.
No.
So it wouldn't have been a very happy life for them until we had all gone.
No, indeed. So when did you actually leave the RAF?
I think it was November 1946.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, what occupation did you go into?
Back to coach building.
To coach building in London?
In London, yes.
Uh-huh.
Back to the same firm, yes.
Yeah, same firm.
Yeah.
Wow.
The only difference when I got back, there was quite a lot of women being taken on.
Right.
Taken on to replace people who'd been called up.
Yes. So did you stay in London working there for a number of years? Or?
Yes, we stopped there for about 18 months, I think. But we had my brother, married brother, very kindly let us have a couple of rooms. We were married then, of course. Have a couple of rooms in his house. He got a house.
Yes.
But, of course, we knew that he wouldn't want us there forever. And the housing situation didn't seem to get any better in London. So we heard of this cottage going up near where I was trained and where Adelaide lived.
Yes.
A nice little cottage. We got the chance of having that. So I got myself a job in that area, in the same trade. And we went up there to live. And we went from there. We've been living in Nottingham with the job. And then we went, I lived in Wales, of course. And the reason for that is because, I mean, my wife always had a bit of connection with Wales because her father, who worked in the horse trade, looking after the gentry's horses, you know, he worked with a man, Papillation, and he came from near Bridgend.
Yes.
And when he went back to Wales during the war, I think it was, well, yes, when the hunting stopped, he went back to Wales, but they always kept in touch. And my father-in-law and mother-in-law used to go and visit them. And in fact, we went there for our honeymoon.
All right.
To there, which was very kind of them, because it's difficult to find any, you know. If you went to a hotel and you had to take a ration book and all that sort of thing,
yes.
Terribly austere life was, you know, just being a young man.
Yes.
You wouldn't realise how austere everything was.
Yes.
This was unavailable, or you got very, very small rations. Even like tools that people needed to work with, they were almost unobtainable, and you had to look around to see if you could buy second-hand ones and that. Clothing, of course, was in very short supply. You don't know what you missed.
I was just a little too young for that. I was born in 1955.
It's just about getting right. It wasn't fully right, I don't think, then.
No.
But it was getting towards that way.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you move to Tanagroes in Ceredigion?
About 12 years ago, I think it was. Son and his wife, they were living in Leicester. And he'd retired from work, and they fancied living in Wales, because they'd been, like us, been to Wales on holidays and that. They took a fancy to Wales. And they were looking for a house of some sort, and they came across this small holding of about 10 acres just down the road from us.
Yes.
Only about 3 miles from us it is. And we thought we would like to move to Wales too. And they looked out and got us this bungalow. Them being on living, already living here, they would be able to keep their eye on the property market and find us something worth looking at. We fell in love with it straight away, and we moved.
Wow.
Into Wales.
Wow. And you and Adelaide have been happy in Tanagroes, have you?
Oh, yes. We always think it's nice here.
Yeah.
Like the people that have never been able to get on with the language, the Welsh language. And I think the trouble is there that you've been speaking English for that many years.
Yes.
And also, your memory. I mean, my long-term memory is quite good, you've probably realised, but
yes.
Short-term memory, you learn a word or two of Welsh, you say, yes, that's it, that's how you pronounce it. Next day, it's completely gone.
Wow.
That's the trouble.
Yes.
So you're certainly not isolated speaking English in Wales these days, are you?
No. It's a very friendly country.
Another
generally.
Thing I remember, I realised that even if you learn Welsh, there's that many Welsh dialects.
There are.
You couldn't be happy in every part of Wales. You've got to have a job to get to understand people there.
No, indeed. Well, I've lived in North Wales.
When I first moved there, I was talking to our neighbour next door, and he was a real old Welshman, and he had a cattle transport business, small cattle transporting business. And I was telling him I couldn't get on with this Welsh. He said, "Don't worry about that," he said. "I can speak Welsh, I understand Welsh," he said. "But I go to a lot of places where they think they're speaking Welsh, but they're not, and I can't understand them." So I thought, well, that leaves me in the clear then. I no need to worry too much.
Yes.
And it's never been a hardship, you know. I mean, any official literature we get is always in
bilingual,
isn't
absolutely.
It?
Yes, so it is.
Anything you want to know.
Right.
So no, we're very glad we moved here.
Good. Well, no, I'm pleased to be able. It's pleased that you have. So we can get this story for the archive. It's wonderful. You know, it is. You know, I do thank you so much for spending the time and going through this.
Talking about it.
You know, I mean, what I'll do, John, is I'll.